I'm Vaughn Batalden, and I am a botanist by training. I teach at a small liberal arts college in New England, and I teach really very little botany. I have to teach things like microbiology and environmental issues and evolution and diversity and things of that sort. But I find economic botany to be very interesting. You know, how is it that we started eating these things? And how did people find out that, you know, you had to cook certain things in order to make them safe to eat? And how many people died trying to figure out what we could eat? I just find it fascinating. And some of those questions I don't think we'll ever have an answer to. But so that's how I got interested. And chocolate seems to be one of those foods that people like to hear about. So that's why I'm talking about chocolate. How many of you have eaten chocolate today? How about in the past week?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a food that most people like. My grandfather did not like chocolate. And as a child, I could not figure out why he wouldn't eat it. And I can remember sitting on his lap and saying, but Grandpa, if you would just try it, you would like it. But he never did. So, first of all, I'm going to talk a little bit about the botany of the plant, a little of the history, a little bit of the processing of chocolate, and a little bit of the economics and a few things of that sort. So it's a little smattering of this, that, and the other thing. But since I'm a scientist, I have to give a few numbers. And if you Google chocolate, you'll get 227 million hits. If you Google cocoa, you get 36 million. And cacao, which is the scientific name, you get 12 million. So, you know, you can find out a lot about chocolate and such things on Google. And if you look on Amazon, you'll get 160,000 books, 28,000 gourmet foods, 18,000 home and garden items, which unfortunately mainly are color. You know, you can have a chocolate-colored canvas chair or something. 8 pieces of software. There's one deadly chocolate. Has anybody ever played deadly chocolate? It's now out of print, but you can get it used on Amazon. And 11 cell phones. It's chocolate blue and chocolate green and chocolate black colors. Yeah. Oh, it's a brand name.
It's a
brand name. Oh, see, I'm so glad.
It's a model.
Okay, thank you very much. And you have to have a few more numbers, too. 4 million metric tons of beans are sold every year, and a metric ton is about 2.3.
Worldwide or just the U.S.?
Worldwide. And 80 million Hershey Kisses can be made a day. They have that capacity, but they make between 30 and 40 million a day. And 40 to 50 million persons depend on the cocoa industry for a livelihood worldwide. And not that many people are employed by Hershey. That's a fairly small number of people. And this number is really variable, how many billion dollars are spent in the U.S. and even on chocolate, because it depends upon how you measure. And some places I've seen 13 billion, 14 billion, 20 billion. So, you know, don't quote me on this as an absolute economic number. And each person in the U.S. eats 11.64 pounds of chocolate. I mean, it's July, just about August. And you should have eaten over half that amount so far.
This month.
Which country do you think eats the most chocolate?
Switzerland.
Yeah.
23 pounds per person.
Where was that?
Switzerland.
Oh, Switzerland.
20 pounds per person. So first we have to do a little bit of botany and talk about how it's grown. It's a tropical tree called Theobroma cacao, which means food of the gods. And it was named by Linnaeus. So actually there should be a little L at the end, because if Linnaeus named it, then we have to forever and all time call it that name. It's the scientific name. And Linnaeus's name was really Carl Linné. But he changed his name to Carolus Linnaeus because he wanted a Latin name, just like he was named Linnaeus. As Paul would say, we do stupid things. And it's a member of the Sterculaceae family and named after the Roman god Stercus, which is the god of decay and carry-on. So I don't know the family for chocolate. The kola nut is in that family too, that they chew like a betel nut with a very high caffeine content in it. The tree will only grow in a relatively small range of the world. It has to be 20 degrees north-south latitude of the equator, an elevation of 13 to 2,300 feet, and it has to be shaded. It has been attempted to grow it in Hawaii in a non-shaded condition, but it requires a lot of fertilizer, a lot of hormones, and it's really not the ideal growing conditions. The temperature has to range from 70 to 85 degrees Fahrenheit, and you need 70 to 90 inches of rain per year. And I don't know how much rain you get here. Not much rain, you get a lot of snow. But in New Hampshire, we only get 48 inches of rain per year on average. So we don't really meet any of those standards. We can do the 13 to 2,300 feet, but the rest of it is we're not going to make. This is the Theobroma cacao tree, and above it is the Glycidria cepium, which is called the mother of cocoa. Because it's the shade that grows over the top. Bananas are sometimes also used as a shade, but they do need the shade. And this just shows where in the world it's grown. So you can see it's not a very broad area of the world where it's grown. It was originally from the Amazon, and then it's been moved around the world. And probably it's been moved from the Amazon by humans from the very get-go.
So is it not anywhere else in the world before 1492?
The Europeans moved it around. But it was in Brazil, moved up into Mexico, but it was not in the...
Not in Indonesia.
It's an evergreen tree with oblong leaves, can grow 15 to 20 feet high. It takes 5 years for it to mature, and it can live for 50 to 60 years. And it has a characteristic of coliferae. Does anybody know what that is? It means that the flowers grow right on the trunk of the tree. And the fruit is produced there, of course, too. And it produces a berry. And they'll produce about 30 to 40 of those berries per year on a tree. And there you see them growing right off the trunk. We don't, in the temperate climates, I don't think we have many trees like that. You see a few of those in the tropics, but it's kind of a rare.
Is that an opposite or an alternate?
Oh, that's a very good question.
What was the question?
If it's an opposite or alternate leaf.
I think
if you look up there, it looks alternate.
So are the coastal beans inside those?
They're inside that. Mm-hmm. The flowers are white with a little yellow, with red streaks on it and this yellow ligule, little tongue-like structure. And they're only about the size of a dime. And they're produced year-round, so that there's a continual production of flowers. But they only last a day. And they're only fertile for a few hours in the morning. So if they don't get pollinated, they're gone. And only 1 to 5% of the flowers that are produced actually produce fruit. So they spend a lot of energy making flowers that never develop. And no one is sure how they are actually pollinated. I mean, what insect pollinates them, whether it's a little midge. They've tried using stingless bees that they add to the ecosystem, and that's not worked very well. And so in some places, they're actually hand-pollinated. Somebody goes around with a little brush and pollinates the flowers to increase the pollination. The fruit itself is about 10 inches long and 4 inches in diameter, kind of the size of a football. So the fruit gets to be very big from this little tiny flower. And they have this very tough covering, and they take half a year to mature, so the short-lived flower produces this fruit that takes so long to develop. And there are 20 to 30 seeds inside this big fruit. And it takes about 20 pods to make 2 to 2.5 pounds of beans. So, you know, when you're eating chocolate, you eat quite a few beans. And they do not drop from the tree. Whether that's always been the case, that they don't drop from the tree, they think that probably always they were eaten by animals on the tree and then hauled someplace else. But they don't fall from the tree, so they have to be cut off. And this is the pulp that's in the inside. It's very kind of a bittersweet kind of pulp, sticky, and those are the beans themselves.
Is that pulp edible?
Yes, and the...
So what, jackfruit?
Yeah. Original use, they think, was eating the pulp. And they may have made an alcoholic beverage out of the pulp. The beans were not the first thing that was probably used by people. But at this point, I don't think it's eaten at all. there are three varieties of cacao that are produced. And one is Criollo, which is about 5 to 10% of the production, high quality. It grows only in South America, Central America. It's not produced anyplace else. It's much more delicate in flavor and much less hardy tree. I mean, it's a little bit harder to grow. Forasteros is about 80% of the cacao that's produced. It's more bitter, more acidic, a much hardier tree, easier to grow in plantations, and it's a little like Arabica and Robusta coffee. You know, one's a little bit better, a little bit harder to grow. And then there's Trinitario, which is about 10 to 15% of the population. And many years ago, the Criollo nearly died out in Trinidad, and they started growing Forasteros, and there was enough of the Criollo to around that cross-pollinated with the Forasteros, and this new species developed, which is quite fine chocolate, but it's not the biggest part of the production. Leading producers today are the Ivory Coast. The most recent figure I saw was 43% of the world's cocoa is produced in the Ivory Coast. And we'll come back and talk about that a little bit more after a bit. Indonesia produces 15%. Brazil, 6%. So what does that get to be? Over half of 61, thank you very much. It's always good to have an economist there. is produced, and 55% is produced not in the area of the world where it was originally produced. And the best is from South and Central America. A little bit about the processing of cacao. The harvesting, fermenting, drying, and perhaps the sorting takes place on the plantations, in the area where it's actually grown. The rest of that, the roasting, the winnowing, and all of that, takes place in other parts of the world, the US and Europe in particular. and we'll come back to that in a minute. As I said earlier, they don't fall from the tree, so they cut them off with a machete. And if you're really good, you can cut off 50 of those in an hour. And you know, how many fingers do you think are lost in cutting those off the trees? And then they take a machete and cut them open and pull out the pulp and the seeds. And the hull is a waste product. and so here's the sweet pulp still on it. That's being taken out of the bags or brought from the forest, from the plantation. And the traditional way is to put them out on banana leaves and then cover them with banana leaves and leave them there for a few days to ferment. And anaerobic bacteria do their work, and number one, it kills the embryo so that they don't grow and rot. But it also starts the process of polyphenol formation is going to be the precursor to what we think of as the taste and flavor of chocolate. Then it has to dry, and then they sort them.
So is that sort of like in tobacco, permits, and it's really a complicated process.
Very complicated, yes.
It's complicated too.
Mm-hmm, and that the biochemical process is pretty complicated.
Can they screw it up? I mean, is it, you know, is it kind of a no-brainer?
I get the impression it's kind of a no-brainer, yeah. So that's the first part of the process. Then they go to the roasting process, and they roast at about 260 degrees, and then if it's going to be cocoa, the dry powder cocoa, they roast at a little higher temperature. And the winnowing is just like, you know, getting the hulls off the beans, so you've just got the nibs, which is basically the cotyledon of the plant. And you can actually buy cocoa nibs. Have any of you ever bought cocoa nibs? You can buy them raw online and roast your own, or you can buy them roasted. And they cost about $18 a pound, something like that. But you know, they're not sweet. They're just very bitter. Then they do the grinding process. And the traditional way of grinding is a matate, which is a grinding stone with a rolling pin kind of thing, and grind them. And now most of them are ground in a much fancier way. But the last time I was looking at a variety of chocolates, you can actually buy stone ground chocolate. I mean, a bar that's made of stone ground chocolate. I didn't think it was anything to write home about. It was a little grainy, so you know. So maybe they didn't stone grind long enough. But you know, it's stone grind cornmeal. It's a lot coarser than other. And then they, the next part is if they're going to do any other processing with it. What you've got here when you've ground it is chocolate liqueur, which is like baking chocolate. It's a paste. And if you press that, you can separate the cocoa butter from the cocoa, and then you have the dry cocoa. excuse me. And if you're going to make what we call chocolate, you actually go through some more processing and add more ingredients. Anybody know what conching is? To me, conch is a shell, but conching is mixing after you add sugar to the pot. And if you're going to add milk, you can add it at that point as well. And it's stirred, low quality chocolate is stirred for 4 to 6 hours. A really good chocolate, about 72 hours. And if you're going to have really, really fine chocolate, some will go up to 6 days. And the mixing increases the temperature from the friction, and it makes the cocoa particles and the sugar particles very, very fine. So it's very smooth.
Excuse me, when you take a tour of the Hershey's plant, mm-hmm. is this the point at which they have those big vats with the yeah. rollers?
That's it, that's yeah. it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It goes forever and ever.
And forever and ever, yeah, if it's going to be really fine. How about tempering? What do you suppose tempering is?
Change
in temperature. You heat it up, cool it down, heat it up, cool it down. And what that does is crystallizes the cocoa butter so it doesn't separate. So you get this nice smooth. And if you ever store chocolate for a while and you take it out of the package and it's got this white coating on, it's just the cocoa butter that's separated out. And so there's really nothing wrong with it. It just doesn't look so pretty. And it also loses its nice snap and luster. The tempering process does that. Then you can shape it into whatever you want, so you can make, you know, Easter bunnies if you want to, and you've got chocolate. So these are, I've basically said some of these things. Yeah?
Typically, would the ratio of sugar to cocoa be?
It depends upon whether you've got sweet chocolate, bittersweet, and we'll get to that in a minute.
Oh, great.
Good question. Yeah. Chocolate liqueur is the, as I said before, it's like baking chocolate. It's just the ground beans. Cocoa butter is the fat that you find in cocoa, and it's about, or cacao. It's about 55% of the chocolate liqueur is the cocoa butter. And the reason we like cocoa butter so much is that it melts just below body temperature. So when you put it on your tongue, it melts, and it's got this nice, smooth, satisfying feeling. Cocoa butter is white chocolate. I mean, except it's got things added to it, but there's no cocoa, no chocolate in white chocolate. It's just the cocoa butter.
And then your U.S. law is not legally chocolate.
No, it's not. And it's also resists rancidity. It doesn't get rancid as fast as a lot of fats do. So the cocoa is when you remove half the fat, you've got cocoa. And chocolate is when you add ingredients, as I said before. And there are definite standards for all of these things that the FDA sets. And there's great disagreement whether if you put an artificial sweetener in it, do you have chocolate? You can't really call it chocolate unless it's got a nutritive sweetener and a certain percentage of chocolate and cocoa butter in it. There are standards. Yes?
So again, the white stuff called white chocolate is really cocoa butter with...
with sugar and some milk in it, yeah. And so you can say made with chocolate if it's not up to standard and some of those labelings, but if it, or even it'll say made with real chocolate, but if that means it's not the real thing, actually. Here's the composition of things. If you've got bitter chocolate, it's 95% chocolate liqueur with a little bit of cocoa butter added. Bittersweet, you've got about half sugar, half chocolate liqueur. If it's really sweet, you've got 70% sugar and 15%. And milk chocolate, you've even got less chocolate liqueur, but you got some milk solids in there.
How does that fit with when you say dark chocolate?
Dark chocolate has to be 41% chocolate liqueur in order to be called dark chocolate. That's one of the standards.
And like the typical semi-sweet chocolate chips, is that just a lesser?
Yeah, it's going to be like bittersweet.
Bittersweet.
Yeah. So a little bit about the history of chocolate. And probably at about 5,000 BCE, they started using the cacao tree. And they think it was only the pulp that was used, not the beans. And how many of you eat the pit of the peach when you just ate the peach a little while ago? You eat the fruit first. The Olmecs started to use the beans, I think. And the Mayans actually started farming it. So the earliest plantations are from the Mayans. And they think when the beans started to be used, it was only as a beverage, so that you made a beverage with the beans. And when I was giving this presentation not long ago, I hadn't read this, but they said that the Mayans mixed blood with the chocolate. But I don't know if that's the case or not.
We're talking Aztecs?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's already been moved up into Central America from Amazon. And they think people need it.
Yes. You say Mayan, that's like Aztecs?
No, that's earlier than the Aztecs. The Aztecs are the ones that were the chocolate culture. They had the big, used chocolate a lot. And it's from there that Cortez and brought it to Europe. So a little bit about the Aztecs. They were the ones that said it was the gift from the gods. and it was their currency. And they think, one bean is equivalent to about our $1 today from in 1545 when Cortez came around. And they actually used beans to pay, you could pay your taxes in cacao beans up until 1877 in Mexico. So, and just to give you an idea of the what you could buy with those beans, one bean would buy you a piece of fruit or a tomato. 100 beans would buy you a slave. 10 beans would buy you a rabbit or a prostitute. And 10 beans would make a very thin beverage. So you can see how, if you could buy a rabbit or only one cup of bitter cocoa, I might go for the rabbit. Yeah. I'm not talking about the prostitute. but it's thought that Montezuma drank 50 cups of chocolate a day.
Whoa.
And so he had people waiting on him making these all the time because you had to grind the beans and then mix it up and to keep it in solution. And this is the molinillo, which was their mixing tool. And you would have to, go mix it up. And so he had a lot of people to make 50 a day for him. And so that, and it wasn't just the cocoa bean, a lot of chili, hot pepper was put into it, and sometimes maybe cornmeal. I'm not sure Montezuma had cornmeal. That would be for people who are a little lower in status. But poor people didn't drink cocoa for the most part. So I think maybe we should pass those around.
Because there's a little intermission here. The kitchen here at Holden has made us pepper chocolate cookies to eat. Mm-hmm. So this is thanks to the kitchen. So we'll pass them around. Everyone help yourself.
And this has their chocolate peppers, so they're real authentic.
So sad you sat upstairs.
And looking at old art and pottery, the cacao seemed to be a symbol of heart and blood and life and a religious symbol. And I don't know if that's why there's some thought that they actually mixed blood and cocoa together. And the history of the name chocolate is uncertain, but there's an Aztec word, chocolatl, that means bitter water, which seems like a reasonable source of the name. But some think that atl means mix, and the choco choco is the mixing of the molineo, the choco choco atl, but bitter water seems probably maybe a better name.
So did the Spanish or the Portuguese introduce it to Europe?
The Spanish. And Columbus probably was acquainted with the cacao when he was in Central America, but saw no value in it, and it seems that he was given some, but it didn't take a hold. But when Cortez came in 1548, they thought he was the white god from afar, and they gave him a cacao plantation, and so he, but he actually traded his beans for gold. So he was more interested. That was very nice of you, Sonia. I think that was a lion up on the top layer there. But Cortez brought the cocoa to Europe. And it was pretty much the Spaniards that kept it to themselves for nearly 100 years. And it suggested that the English buccaneers actually attacked a Spanish ship to get the cocoa. So it was fairly popular. And the first shipment to Europe was in 1585, which was earlier than coffee was introduced. So it was the first stimulant in Europe, non-alcoholic stimulant. So, it was a. Now I'll go back again. And initially, it was for the aristocratic folks, and it was a medicinal. And an aphrodisiac. Then eventually there were salons where people would go and eat chocolate. Drink chocolate. It's still a drink. But Europeans started adding sweetener to it, so it was a sweeter drink. And it was debatable whether women should be allowed to drink a cocoa because it was an aphrodisiac. And you can't trust women to drink something like that. But the French women were eventually allowed to drink it, but not the British women. And then there was a debate in the church whether or not you could have cocoa before you went to Mass. Was it a food or was it a beverage? And in the end, it was ruled a beverage, and so you could drink it before you went to Mass. And so then it became popular for aristocratic women to bring their cocoa with them to Mass. So it was an interesting period. But then when it was introduced to Europe and it became this popular beverage, then the Europeans brought it to Africa and to Indonesia. The Dutch brought it to Indonesia. It was at the same time that slavery was introduced into Central America and the sugar plantations. And so it was all intermixed economically. Increase the growth of chocolate and or cocoa and sugar.
Well, Vaughn,
yes.
Do you know the timing of tea? The spread of tea drinking?
a very good question.
It would have been earlier.
I think it would be earlier.
Yeah, that was 12 something.
The Marco Polo type?
Marco Polo.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
What's the percentage, is it caffeine is the stimulant?
It's theobromine is the main one. Theobromine, I'll talk about this in a minute. Good question.
Can you talk a little louder?
What?
Can you talk any louder?
I can. Then Dutching was introduced in 1828. Anybody know what Dutching is? Dutching is the adding of alkali, either sodium or potassium carbonate, and it makes it mix in with the water easier, so you can make a beverage faster. But we now know that it also destroys a lot of the polyphenols, the flavanols and things in that give it its health benefit. So I used to think Dutch chocolate was really fine, but really Dutch chocolate is not as good. Mm-hmm. As far as if you want to eat it for health purposes.
Is that the same as Dutch process?
Yes, Dutch process. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is there another way to eat it other than
health? But it wasn't, up until this time, it had only been a beverage. And in 1849, Fry introduced the possibility of eating it as a solid and not as a beverage. And I think most of us eat chocolate as a solid, not as a beverage. And in 1874, Meunier started a chocolate village. And Hershey followed suit later, and Nestle did the same thing. They had a chocolate village. And I think we tend to think of company towns as not very good for the workers. But at that time, it was the best place to work. Your kids got to go to school, you got health care, you were paid a livable wage, so that it was really, they were on the forefront of the labor, good conditions for labor.
Where was Meunier?
As far as roasting.
When you got to the roasting process, yeah, right. I think it's Belgium. And Nestle, and then Lindt started the conching to make this nice smooth chocolate. So a little bit of the history. Some of the ingredients, we kind of did a little bit of this before, but in really high quality chocolate, you've got 50 to 70% solids. You add some, may add some extra cocoa butter and pure vanilla extract, a little bit of lecithin, which is a little bit of a stabilizer, but it's a naturally occurring product. Mass-produced chocolate tends to have less cocoa solid. You add vegetable fat, but you really can't call it true chocolate if it's got vegetable fat, only if it's got cocoa fat. So that's when made with real chocolate kind of thing. So, and synthetic vanilla. What?
Getting real chocolate means made with vegetable fat.
Yeah. So a little bit about health. I don't. When I was growing up, you shouldn't eat chocolate because it causes acne. Yes. And the last time I gave this talk, I think nobody in the room was under 75. So I didn't care too much about that. Anyway. But there are studies done at the U.S. Naval Academy and Penn State, and there's no relationship with chocolate and acne.
So my mother just said that so she could eat the chocolate.
And there may be people who are a little bit sensitive to chocolate, but true allergies are really rare. One study that took people that said they were allergic to chocolate, only 5% had really any reaction at all when they were given chocolate. So there aren't many allergies. And cavities? Well, just let me tell you this. Chocolate has cocoa butter and tannins that coat your teeth, and so the sugar can't even get there.
Oh, no.
Migraine headaches. Some people feel that there's cravings for chocolate with migraine headaches, or that chocolate bring on migraine headaches. But whether you had carob powder or cocoa, it didn't make any difference in studies. So. Obesity, you know, you shouldn't eat chocolate because it makes you fat. In a bittersweet chocolate bar, one of these that has, you know, like 70% chocolate, has a 3-ounce bar has 170 calories. If you have a big Whopper, it has 750. A vanilla milkshake, 750. So you know, it's not the chocolate that's really going to make you fat, especially if you go with ones with a little less sugar. And you know, it's not really empty calories because, just let me go back to the empty calories. You know, there's protein in it, there's minerals, you know, it's really and this, I'm sure you'll really be happy to hear this. If you, Harvard did a study, if you eat chocolate 3 times a month, you will live 1 year longer. So you'll live forever. See, this is just to show you what, how much protein and minerals you've got in these things. And, you know, the cocoa, just eat that dry powder. So what is it that gives you these wonderful health benefits? There are so many chemicals in cacao. You know, it's a complex organic material. So what all the chemicals are and what they do, but theobromine is the compound that is the main stimulant in chocolate, and it has it's a bronchodilator, and it's a cough suppressant. So it is used in those as a bronchodilator. It does contain caffeine, and I'm not sure about this, but some places I read said that there is no caffeine in the original bean. In the processing, some of it is transformed into caffeine from the theobromine because they're related. But anyway, in a processed chocolate bar, there are about 30 milligrams in a chocolate bar compared to 150 in a cup of coffee. So there's not so much in chocolate.
So the coffee.
Mm-hmm. No, that's what they. That's what I'm not positive of that, but that's what's without any processing or roasting. And the polyphenols in it stimulate the production of nitrous oxide, which is a tissue hormone that's produced on site that that dilates arterioles, so it actually increases your blood flow. And there are antioxidants, flavanols, polyphenols, that we all hear about antioxidants that will break down these superoxides and things that your body produces. But going along with the nitrous oxide, it seems to have an effect on platelets similar to the effect of an aspirin, small aspirin, but the effect doesn't last quite as long. So if your doctor said you're supposed to take a small aspirin every day, please don't switch to chocolate on
you. You just need it in regular doses.
Very good point. Repeated doses. ORAC, our oxygen, I have to look up what that is. Fell off my mind. Oxygen radical absorbance capacity. And that's the measurement of the ability to destroy these oxygen radicals that cause aging and all those bad things. And look at how much dark chocolate has in it. You know, milk chocolate is 25. You know, broccoli is supposed to be so great for you. I mean, dark chocolate is so much dark chocolate. One of the problems is the processing kind of destroys some of those. So Mars is actually doing a lot of research on how to process the cocoa to maintain the highest possible antioxidants. So I won't guarantee that the chocolate you're eating has that many, but you can lose a lot of them and still be better than broccoli.
We should have done this research when I was growing up.
And it's the phenylethylamine that really gives chocolate the love drug title, because it releases the natural opiates, you know, the kind of things that are released in orgasm and all those good things. Unfortunately, there's more of that in cheddar cheese and salami. Anandamide stimulates the same receptors as marijuana. You know, so it's a natural, gives you a high. But you'd have to take 25 pounds of chocolate to get the same amount.
It's one 2 years.
But there are ethylamines in the chocolate that maintain and then the effect.
Sorry, could you say that one more time?
There are two ethylamines in chocolate that maintain the effect of the nandamine for longer than marijuana, so you don't have to have as much, it lasts long. And then cocoa butter, you know, you put it on your skin and all makes you, you don't even age if you put cocoa butter on. But it does have saturated fats in it, but studies indicate that even though there are saturated fats in it, the way your body processes it does not raise your LDL. But, you know, if your doctor told you don't eat chocolate because of your cholesterol level, please don't start eating chocolate. So, cravings. Women crave chocolate more than men, and Caucasian women crave it more than Hispanic. So, and they can be, the craving can be satisfied by milk chocolate, but not by cocoa capsules. So whether or not so just how much of the craving is for the actual cocoa itself is unclear. And there's no physiological withdrawal with chocolate, so it's probably not an addiction. So anyway, there's no physiologic change. So, what's the future of chocolate? There need to be a few more health studies. Some of these are a little bit, you know, limited. And then the whole world of luxury chocolate is just booming. You can have chocolate parties with a chocolate sommelier coming to your home and describing them all, just like, you know, wine tasting parties. If you go to, I think it's Trader Joe's in Union Station, there are 120 different kinds of chocolate bars, or chocolate candies, or chocolate candy. And just the other day in the newspaper, I think it's in Berkeley, where somebody has opened a chocolate beverage shop, you know, like a Starbucks, except it only serves chocolate. Or cocoa, but it's, you know, the original bitter cocoa, and you can add the chili peppers and all different herbs and spices and whatever. It's a whole new luxury chocolate way of eating. What?
Not with blood.
Probably not blood. I don't think so. At least I'd like to know, because I don't want So it's a huge business. Environmentally, one of the problems with chocolate is that, or the Theobroma cacao, is it's very susceptible to fungi, a fungus disorder, and that kills the trees. And so that quite a few pesticides have to be used in order to keep the tree alive. And you can imagine in a where it's warm, humid area, their fungus is going to do real fine. So it's not surprising that they have trouble. And then you have them in plantations where, you know, monoculture, it spreads from tree to tree with ease. So that's one issue. A much bigger issue is the whole labor issue. The Ivory Coast has a huge problem with slavery, slave labor, child slave labor. Boys from about the age of 12 to 16 that are not usually from the Ivory Coast, but especially from Mali. Most of them come from Mali. Mali's very poor, and it's not unusual for historically for children, especially boys, to be sent to live somewhere else to learn a trade. And so the family is destitute, and here's somebody where the boys can go and learn a trade and make some money to send home to the family, except no money is ever sent home to the family. And they live, they're fed very little, and live in very poor conditions, and they're locked in at night so they can't run away. And so it's not a very good situation. And it's estimated that there are about 15,000 young boys that are held as slaves at any given time. And it's not always easy to locate them because some of the plantations, farms, are way out in the way where a lot of people don't go. And traditionally, children worked hard in these countries. And so to see children working in the fields is not unusual. And people who own the plantations, their own children would be working in the field. So it's not a simple, it isn't like they're in balls and chains out there working. But in 2000, there was a bill, it tried to be added to the agricultural bill in the US, that chocolate had to be labeled not made with slave labor. And the it did not pass because of the chocolate industry efforts, because they said it would make it even more difficult for the cocoa farmers if that were done, because it would destroy the market. And the chocolate market is fairly volatile, the commodities market, and it's gone down in recent years, so then that puts more pressure on the Ivory Coast, which their main export, their main source of income is cocoa export. So it's a complex situation. But the Harkin-Engel Protocol came out as a result of this effort to add to the agricultural bill that was developed by the chocolate industry itself, that they would improve the efforts to find out what the conditions were under which chocolate was grown. And it started out with just surveys trying to find out exactly what the problem was. And by 2005, July 1st, 2005, they were going to have implemented a system that would decrease the amount of child labor. And at that point, sort of a 1% improvement had occurred. And so then it was extended to 2008. And now it's been extended to 2010. So they're working on the problem, but it's certainly not solved. And part of it is just the bad economic conditions in the Ivory Coast and the countries around there. I mean, so it's difficult. But all of this chocolate is fair traded chocolate, so you know that it's not been grown under those conditions. It's been from small farmers where they actually get the proceeds. And you can look on the labels of chocolate and find out that kind of information. Hershey's probably isn't going to tell you that, but a lot of the other chocolate. You can also find out, most chocolate is a mixture. Beans come from many different places. But you now, more and more, you can buy candy that or chocolate that says the country it came from. It came from Bolivia, it came from Ecuador, comes from Ghana. I've not seen the Ivory Coast. I think they don't want to advertise that. So that you can, and Ivory Coast is the main country where the slavery is the problem.
Does Indonesia use slave labor, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of. And I've not seen chocolate that's labeled from Indonesia either. I don't know if anybody else has.
Is the Ivory Coast mainly supplying to large companies like Hershey?
They produce 43% of the chocolate. And if you want to read more about it, there are some books. And www.candyusa.org is where you can sort of get updates on this Harkin-Engel protocol and what kind of farmers they use. Questions? Yes.
I've always thought the similarity of flavor between chocolate and coffee, and then they both contain caffeine. Is there any relation between those two?
Nope, they're different.
Really?
They're not related. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'd love to add a little bit that kind of relates to what you're talking and addresses a little bit about that. I actually brought some chocolate-covered espresso brand things with me, which I'd be glad to pass around. They're just Trader Joe's brand. So if you like them, you can have them. If you don't want them, that's fine. Coffee, of course, originated in Ethiopia, but quickly spread to the Arabian Peninsula and grew in Yemen. And it's there, it's not cultivated as much. A lot of it is almost kind of just allowed to grow on its own, and then they harvest it from the trees. So a lot of times the coffee beans tend to be a little bit smaller. They tend to use the natural method for taking the cherries off the trees, which means they just let it dry. The reason I'm telling you about Yemen is because the capital in Yemen, I believe, was, and I gotta make sure I know what I'm talking about. Actually, the port that the coffee was distributed from was Mocha. And so this is where probably late 15th century, early 16th century, since it was after chocolate, that the explorers started to come into Mocha to buy the coffee to take back to Europe and other areas. And the coffee was very strongly guarded as far as it was okay to take the coffee, the finished product with you, the coffee beans, but you were not allowed to take coffee plants out of the country. One of the reasons that they believe that Mocha started being associated both with coffee and with chocolate is because the coffee beans from Yemen tend to give a nice cocoa-ness flavor to coffee. When you drink coffee from Yemen, it tends to have more of that dryness in your mouth. It evaporates more quickly and leaves kind of a cocoa-y flavor in your mouth. And so they believe that that's where that comes from. So that kind of helps with the connection.
Thank you.
Wow.
Any other questions? Yes.
Another one. What are some of the biggest chocolate companies, the biggest buyers of these beans?
Hershey.
Cadbury. Really like that huge in the national scale, or the
world
scale?
Mm-hmm. Very big. Nestle.
Cadbury.
Schaffenberger has been bought up by
Hershey.
Cadbury.
Mars.
Mars. I think Mars is part of Hershey.
If pesticides are used in the process of growing.
No. You can buy organic chocolate.
That's all organic.
This is all organic.
It is.
Hmm?
Is there a trade? The chocolate in the hand
is a vegetable. Oh, yeah. Is the cocoa that's in that Holden Village uses that to mix, you know, the little container, is that fair trade?
I don't think so, but I don't know. Is the cocoa used here fair trade?
The cocoa in the dining hall that you mix.
Well, thank you all.
Should we get the recipe for the cookies?
Yeah.
Sonia, can you get the recipe for the cookies?
The kitchen has it. I asked them if it was in the new cookbook, which I actually don't know if it is. They are Martha Stewart's chocolate pepper cookies.
The cookies are Martha Stewart's chocolate pepper cookies.
So, on the campus of St. Olaf College, at a certain time of year, the whole college smells like chocolate because they're using some byproduct, grinding up and putting
cocoa
in the
hulls.
Flower bed. So, what? Where are they getting that?
Is that's the hull from the winnowing.
Okay. And it's apparently a very good It used to just all be thrown away.
Yeah.
Now they're using it as mulch in gardens, and it really is a lovely smell in a garden.
It doesn't break down as fast either, probably because we don't have the same microbes here that break down.
But I mean, mulch from South America would.
Is there a theory about how the cocoa, or the cocoa bean, or whatever it's called, cacao, was first tasted? Was it the smell as you walked by the tree that says,
I don't think there's much smell until
well,
you
Well, I've been by a cocoa tree, or a cacao, whatever you call it. Boy, you walk by the, that's a nice smell.
I didn't think there was so much smell until it got fermented.
I don't know, but anyway, it was a tree. But somebody had to figure out, well, let's give this a try.
That's a fascinating question. And many of these things have been eaten for so long that we don't know why these things.
Her bean, there seems to be an enormous amount of waste from the big husk.
You got the big husk, you got the...
What is there anything being done with all that stuff, or what happens to that?
I think it's left sort of as fertilizer underneath the trees. That's my impression. That's what I mentioned. And the pulp stuff is what is food for the fermentation process.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.